Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, Amani Perry, recent recipient of the 2022 National Book Award for Nonfiction, discusses her book, South to America, A Journey Below the Mason-Dixon to Understand the Soul of a Nation. Perry is joined by Dawn Turner. This episode, presented in conjunction with our special exhibit, Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice, in which Perry and her work is featured. Explore Dark Testament today at the American Writers Museum. The following conversation originally took place May 15th, 2022, at the American Writers Festival and was recorded live.
Hello, everyone. My name is Noelle Velasco, and I'm one of the program coordinators at the American Writers Museum. I'd like to welcome you all to this program at the American Writers Festival, celebrating the past, present, and future of American writing. Our final program of the day is also presented in connection with our upcoming initiative, Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers and Justice, which uplifts the contributions Black writers have had in American history, culture, and daily life in the period between the end of the Civil War and the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. In Amani Perry's latest book, South to America, she returns to the region she has always called home and considers it with fresh eyes. Her journey is full of detours, deep dives, and surprising encounters with places and people. She renders Southerners from all walks of life with sensitivity and honesty, sharing her thoughts about a troubling history and the ritual humiliations and joys that characterize so much of Southern life. Weaving together stories of immigrant communities, contemporary artists, exploitative opportunists, enslaved peoples, unsung heroes, her own ancestors, and her lived experiences, Imani Perry crafts a tapestry unlike any other. Imani Perry is the Hughes Rogers Professor of African American Studies at Princeton University and the author of 7 books, including the award-winning titles Looking for Lorraine, The Radiant and Radical Life of Lorraine Hansberry, and May We Forever Stand, A History of the Black National Anthem. She's interviewed today by Dawn Turner, an award-winning author and journalist. Her most recent book, 3 Girls from Bronzeville, was named a notable book of 2021 by the New York Times and the Washington Post, among others. Welcome to you both.
Thank you guys so very much for coming out this evening, and I am so honored. It's such a pleasure to be here with you, Imani.
That's mutual.
Thank you. I am so effusive in praise for this book. I absolutely loved it. It's wonderful, and if you don't have it, please go out and get it. I think I love it in part because it's such a sweeping book. It's so expansive. It's about the South, so it has to be. But you cover history, economics, racism, environmental racism, black nationalism, white nationalism, the Confederacy, and on and on and on. And there is, I have to include hip hop. You cover hip hop. and there is a point where you kind of ponder, you think about whether or not the South or a portion of the South could be the heartland of America. And that kind of dovetails with your subtitle of the book when you call it The Soul of the Nation. So how is the South both the heart and the soul of this country?
Yeah, so thank you for being in conversation with me. You know, so one answer to that question is it's where it began. Mm-hmm. Right? And one of the things I say is, it's hard to identify a single beginning to this yep. nation, right? So the beginning has to do with European encounter with this land, the enslavement of African people, the domination and the removal of indigenous people, and their various European nations vying for power, right? But do we start where Florida is in 1500? Do we start in Jamestown in 1619? Where do we start? But all of it started in the South, right? Because it's this place of incredible abundance, right? People, you know, so these settlers come and they're just, their minds are blown by the abundance of the landscape, you know, and then greed takes over, and what they'll do to people in order to harness the landscape is the tragedy of our history. So one answer is that's where it begins. Another answer is that's where the wealth was produced.
Sure.
That's what allows the United States to become a global power, particularly in the antebellum period with King Cotton, the incredible wealth of the nation. You know, first you have tobacco and sugar, and then but cotton, right? And then you look at the actual creation of the nation state, right? And mm-hmm. and the way in which federalism allows the South to move the country about to this very day, right?
Sure.
So it's fascinating because it's the region that is depicted as backwards, out of step, mm-hmm. the repository for the nation's sins. We don't know what those folks are doing down there, right? Mm-hmm. But that actually has moved, it's the engine. Yep. And I always ask, what are you talking about, oil, or you're talking about coal, or you're talking... And so for me, part of the reason I have to go to through all of these sort of landscapes, both physically but also like sort of conceptually and thematically, is to make this point. Mm-hmm. We have to shift our lens to actually understand how the country works, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you actually open the book, or your introduction begins with this dance.
Yes.
The French quadrille.
Yes.
And that when you just said out of step, and so you use that dance. At that point, we had just, or the country had just purchased Louisiana.
Yes.
And you use that the dance as a metaphor for how we continue to perceive the South as being out of step with the
right.
rest of the country. So talk a little bit more about
that. Yeah, and it's great. You know, this quadrille is wonderful because it's metaphor and it's literal. So
yeah.
there are these balls to celebrate the purchase of Louisiana. And so there's this tension between the French and the English. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways the tension emerges is over how they do the quadrille differently,
yeah.
right? And, you know, so the idea was, okay, well, we'll take turns. Like, first we'll have an English dance, and then we'll have a French dance. But there winds up being a conflict because the English quadrille takes longer to do, and so the songs get out of sync, and there's a conflict over what song is going to get played, and it turns into a very violent episode, right? And it's funny, but it's also about the negotiation yep. over power in yep. this land, right? And then in sort of these two European communities negotiating over power, who's going to be able to sort of use this land to become a global power or to sustain a global power in aspiration of France, which ultimately they didn't prevail. And then and that's in New Orleans. And then elsewhere, there's Congo Square in the same city where the Africans who are captive dance. And there's a whole different set of dances, right? And those dances are, in some ways, for me, representative of the freedom dreams, right? Mm-hmm. So, because if we say, okay, the South is where all of these horrific things happen, but it's also the site of incredible beauty, right? The American musical tradition, the American dance tradition, and also the tradition of freedom dreaming.
And they're all, they're decked out.
Yes.
They're dressed
They're adorned
so elegantly.
Beautifully. Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so it really does speak to the largesse of whether, I mean, you are the beneficiary of it or you aspire to you that kind of American dream
yeah.
where we try to work to, and not just to have things, items, but just to be
expression.
In a
expression. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah,
and
imagination.
Astounding.
Yeah.
How did you, I guess as a writer, I'm interested in knowing, and when did you read about the dance, or you read about that moment, the
yes.
Louisiana Purchase, and how people celebrated around the area, and then you said, well, this is a great metaphor for, you know, then and now?
Yeah, well, so it's hard because, okay, so I did set dancing when I was a child of the 70s, right?
Right?
Yeah. And so I'm, you know, and I danced, I studied dance anyway,
yeah.
and so I'm always sort of reading about dance, and then I knew, and I'm also I'm really fascinated by Louisiana in particular as this sort of inflection point in national history.
Mm-hmm.
So it sort of just, it came about, like I'd read this story and it just kind of came up again
okay.
in the context of the book. And then also I came across this political cartoon that referred to the sort of sectional conflict as a political quadrille.
Right.
And I was like, oh, okay, so we can pull these pieces
right.
together.
Yeah.
But here's the other piece. I wanted the book to allow people to feel as though they were walking through time and space.
Mm-hmm.
And so couldn't just be sort of analytical description of sort of the negotiations between the estates. It actually, I needed scenes, right? I needed people to imagine themselves in that place of incredible tension and violence, yeah. And also, and so, you know, I looked for those locations that would illustrate the points I was trying to make.
Well, I think that when I said I love the book, I mean, that is really what, that's one of the things I loved about the book is that there's so many examples. So you make a point, and then there are just these rich examples that kind of hit the point home in so many different ways. And I felt that throughout the book, that I was in this time and this space, and I was learning throughout. I know that you you used Albert Murray, and I'll say that Albert Murray was a black intellectual, and you used this 1971 book called South to a Very Old Place, and that was a direct inspiration for this book.
Absolutely.
And so in his book, he starts in Harlem, and then he's also from Alabama. You're from Alabama. And so the first chapter really gives us this sense of him. He's taking the train, he's talking about Columbus Circle. I mean, he's like all of these things that remind him of the South. Then we're in the South. And so I'm wondering if because he was such an integrationist, he was a devout integrationist, if from the time you began the book to the time that you were done with it, did you have a sense of, because he believed that our fates, whether you're an indigenous person, a white person, a black person, or whatever, that they're so intertwined that there's no way that the country can move forward unless we work together. What was your thinking on that as you worked?
So I will confess, Albert Murray is, in general, one of the most significant influences on me, and also someone who I'm always in disagreement with.
Okay.
And and it's not on that point. But more that, you know, so I cite really briefly, there was a lot more that didn't make it into the book about Toni Morrison's review of his book, South to a Very Old Place, in which she said, you know, basically the book is beautiful, but he acts like the black people in this country have no relationship to black people anywhere else in the world, right? And I agreed with her on that criticism, and partially, and she talks about he could go places much souther. Yeah. And she gestures to the Caribbean, which is part of why I actually go to the Caribbean at the end of the book. But he's making an argument about, he's a deep integrationist, and also talks about Americans resemble each other more than they do anyone else. Americans, and I don't think that's necessarily wrong, right? But I do think that there's also something to learn about the relationships that we sustain with people in other parts of the world, and consistent with Zora Neale Hurston, consistent with Morrison, consistent with Sterling Brown. So I wanted to kind of play with that text in the way that it's always sort of playing with me, like it's always in the back of my mind. He also does this interesting thing in that book, which is he's moving between like the academic world and the experiential. And I did more of that in the earlier versions, and I was like, but I'm actually an academic, so it can push, like, you know, so I pulled back on some of that. I had in his book, there's a whole motif about Yale. I had a motif about that in the original version. I was like, I'm going to ease up on that. But really what he was trying to do, which is similar to what I was doing. He, in that moment, 1971, people were talking about a new South. Right. And he was like, it's not that new, right? It's not that new. And in some ways I'm saying, it's not that it's not that different than the rest of the nation. It's not that different. You know, it really is the heartbeat. Yeah.
You know, I mean, what's really interesting to me, I think one of the reasons why I really love this book is because it is, I mean, it's very much academic. It's so well researched and it's well thought out. And so I could see it being taught in a classroom. But at the same time, it's so human. And I felt that your first trip to West Virginia, and you get there thinking, you talk to a Confederate soldier reenactor, And you get there, and you're thinking you're going to kind of, you know, have a discussion with him that's a little heartier than it turns out to be. And then you kind of, you chastise yourself for not asking him the harder questions. He talks about being, you know, working in Washington, D.C.
Right.
And I think he works as an archivist. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so he's got this kind of government job. Mm-hmm. And so there are these questions that you can ask him, and then you kind of wonder, does he hate his job because he works in a chocolate city?
Right.
Or so there are all of these, and so that's one of the things that I loved about the book is that it is very much highbrow, completely accessible, but it's also it's heartfelt. And you really stand before us as both as a brilliant human being, but also as a person whose steps kind of from time to time aren't as steady. Mm-hmm. And so talk about West Virginia and the Confederate reenactment.
Yeah, so part of it is I had met Tony Horowitz, the late Tony Horowitz, brilliant historian who wrote Confederates in the Attic. And I had an issue with the book, as much as I liked him, because I felt he was too sympathetic to Confederates, the Confederate reenactors.
Yeah.
And then I interact with this Confederate reenactor, and it's a little bit tender, it's very skeptical, but it gives me this opportunity early in the book to do what I intended. One of the things I say is a book is not a history, it's a true story. Because a history is a particular genre of writing, right? It's an argument.
Yep.
It's a structured argument. This is not. Right. This is.
There are arguments.
There are arguments, yeah, but it's.
Structure.
But part of my exposure of myself as a fallible storyteller is actually that it is intended as an invitation to reconsider.
Yes.
So I want the reader to trust me, but the reader doesn't have to agree with everything that I say and do. And one of the things is probably that I didn't push with this man. I was fascinated by him, but I also wanted to illustrate the point, something that I learned as a socialization as a little Southern Black girl many, you know, years ago.
Not that many.
Yeah, you know. I'll be 50 this year, okay. So it's many. There's a politeness that is not obsequious. Mm-hmm. It is, we're going to maintain a distance on certain issues so that things don't pop off too bad, right? Like there's a detente. Okay, we're not going to go there.
Right.
And which is complicated for someone who's a writer, who's discovering, because you're like, but if I don't go there, I might be misreading this scenario. And so I'm constantly struggling with that question. But at any rate, I thought, here's the piece, the core of it. So he tells me this story. He reenacts for a Maryland Confederate regiment. And he tells me this story how in the 80s, early 90s, he goes on a field for reenacting. You know, they sleep outside and do all this stuff. It's fascinating, sort of. And they tell him, you got to get off this field because you have these modern glasses. Mm-hmm. You need glasses from the antebellum period. So he buys these, he gets these original glasses, right?
For $400.
They're $400 back then.
Yeah.
So they're obscenely expensive.
Right.
So he can be on the field, so he can lay in the dirt. And then he can't see out of them.
Right.
Thick. They're so thick. He can't. And I was like, it's a perfect metaphor, though,
right,
for the lens of a Confederate
beautiful
imagination, right?
Yes.
There's a distortion
right
of history.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, he and I are so similar because we both are trying to live inside history.
Right.
And I just write it.
Yeah. And you extend him a level of empathy, though. And that's one of the challenges that we as Black people often face is our story, whether it's the war on drugs or whatever. I mean, there isn't always that empathy to understand the background. And there was another moment that I love with the Lyft driver in Charlottesville.
Yeah.
That's another moment of empathy. When this is a woman who is, now she's from North Carolina, the Bible Belt.
Yes.
And so you get into her Lyft, and she says, she starts to talk about all kinds, all manner of
all
religious,
her business.
Tammy Faye.
Yes.
Yeah, all of her business, all of that. And at the end of the ride, she says, do you want to pray with me? And you say, yes.
Yeah.
And I was just, I was really, and I have to say, I grew up in the church. but I was really moved by that because you immediately said yes.
Yeah.
But I love the way you ended that chapter because you were saying, like, I hope you're not praying to the God. If you could pray to the God of the slaves,
yeah,
a more generous God.
Yes.
So talk a little bit
about that. Yeah, I draw this distinction in the book between the God of masters and the God of slaves.
Yes.
Is there two competing religious traditions? Christian religious traditions in this country. So her God, she described as someone who, you know, if you were saved, you would rule like sitting next to God, like kings and queens. And I thought, who are you ruling over?
Right.
What are you imagining? And then I thought, in contrast, the tradition out of which I come is one, you know, it's the Exodus tradition.
Yeah.
And so it's a let my people go. It's freedom. And so we had the same texts, the same religious texts in a very different interpretation. And her response to her experience of humiliation and degradation and being abandoned by her husband was to imagine being a ruler, right? And I was trying to suggest, oh, but you could imagine the way we do.
Right.
Not imagine being a ruler, right? Imagine being free. And so for me, the prayer was about, you know, when at one point I talk about having more empathy for the so-called hillbillies than the one who wrote their elegy, mm-hmm. J.D. Vance. But it's real.
Yeah.
It's real,
right.
Because there are levels of oppression,
right,
and exploitation. And he is someone, you know, who sees them as shameful.
Right.
And I... Even as I understand that those very communities hinge their sense of self-worth on being superior to us, I can also recognize the ways in which they suffer, right? I think the meth crisis is very similar to the lean crisis.
Absolutely.
Right? They're coming from the same place. There's
right.
There's so much common ground, and so I want to be honest about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, and I so appreciate that because when I read Hillbilly Elegy, And I was just, and so, and the J.D. Vance of then, 2016, when we were introduced to him, to the one who's standing before us now, I mean, very similar but very different, very complicated.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the opioid crisis in West Virginia. The whole idea that West Virginia, before it broke off from its eastern cousin, and broke off because of the slave issue.
Yeah.
And now the way that we perceive, even when I was reading J.D. Vance's book, because he grew up in Appalachia before the family moved to Ohio. Mm-hmm. And so the way we perceive, I mean, and not just perceive, but the media images of West Virginia, it's so, you lose that whole story. Mm-hmm. About the, you know, the people on the eastern part or the western part of the state being against, and maybe not wholesale, but really that wasn't mm-hmm. slavery not being their thing. But this is one of the things that you deal with in that section, and then you go back to it later, is this whole idea of race and that they're working class white people or impoverished white people. They're still so, not everybody, but there's still this, they're so connected to their whiteness. And it trumps, if I can use that as a verb, it trumps the whole, their needs, their interests. So can you talk a little bit about that? You write that one way to read this is, and this is further in the book, is in simple Marxian terms, the working class was divided against itself by means of the false consciousness of race.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is, I mean, you know, this is, it's not novel because, you know, this is what Du Bois was saying,
right.
You know, 90 years ago. I think what I try to, you know, this observation, right, that when you get the only thing, so often the only thing these folks have is whiteness.
Yes.
Right? And that feels vulnerable and frail, and then is held on to tightly. But I also you know, so that I want to make that point, but also talk about that then what happens is a suppression also of the labor movement history in Appalachia, and so it also kind of distorts a class consciousness of the vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And it's also, there's something really heartbreaking because there's all these moments of possibility that get, you know, diminished because, or get, you know, squandered because of the ideology of white supremacy. And Appalachia is a great place to talk about that because, you know, on the one hand, you have all the mining wars and this incredible history of miners just pushing back. And, you know, and we're still living in the aftermath of that because, you know, we have, you know, crypto, you know, mining that's taking place in the place and sucking energy and an environmental hazard. And we have Manchin, who is still a coal boss, even without, you know, the same mines. I mean, it's just this, the reality is still present. And race is still used to distort so much. And then also, when there are Black Appalachian Afro-Latians, as they call themselves, right? In beautiful literary and cultural tradition, and they music. Always get the and they always are the most vulnerable there, right? Which is how, you know, that's, you know, canaries in the coal mine as metaphor is quite potent. So it's tend to all of the layers. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And how, why things are the way they are.
Right.
Right, yeah.
So your book, and I don't know if I said this earlier, so you take this trip.
Yes.
So you're going to, you pop in and out of different places mm-hmm. in the South. I know I've said I was moved so many times, but I'm going to say it again. At the end of the chapter titled Animated Roulette, Louisville.
Yeah.
You talk about, well, I mean, during the chapter, you talk about Breonna Taylor, who was murdered. No-knock warrant. But Louisville is also the place of the Kentucky Derby.
Derby? Yeah, Derby.
Right. And so at the end of the chapter, you talk about one of the owners, whose name is J.S. Stables, and he has a three-year-old filly that's running, and he, or somebody there, names the filly Breonna. And so when you're telling the story, I mean, I'm wondering if, I mean, was this a tone that, they said that they wanted to name the filly that in order to honor her, is it a tone deaf moment, or was it actively malicious? I'm just wondering.
I mean, I don't think it was actively malicious to name the horse Breonna. But it made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up, right? Because you think how easy it is to sort of imagine Black people as chattel once again. That's how it registered to me. It doesn't seem like an honor. I mean, I had a similar reaction when a famous actress named her pig Booker T. Washington, Black pig Booker T. Washington.
Right.
You know, and thought it was funny or cute. But this was more harrowing.
Right.
And that combined with the history of the Derby and the way in which, you know, Black jockeys as superb athletes are pushed out, and the way in which the people who work the stables are so incredibly vulnerable, and the sort of late, so now it's mostly undocumented people, but the generations of people who live behind the stables and this unbelievable excess and display that's part of the Derby scene and what's underneath it, and what looks very elegant on the surface is really funky underneath.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
absolutely.
Yeah, so that's sort of like, okay, so maybe on the surface one might be able to interpret this as a homage, but what it feels like underneath is very, very, at the very least, disturbing.
Yeah, and that was exactly what I got when I read it. Your stop in Washington, you call it the ironic capital.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, I think it's so interesting. You know, so there's this big question, is D.C. the South, mm-hmm. right? And I admit that when I lived in D.C., I never thought of it as the South, like even a little bit.
Yeah.
But it's where it is because
below the Mason.
It is there because the southern states paid the Revolutionary War debt, and they said we need the capital near us.
Right.
All of those Virginia planters who were early presidents and the like.
That's right.
So it is the South, but it's also it is stripped of its southernness and its depiction as the national capital, and even in the way that. It's the story of DC is told is a modern story, but part of what I want to do there is they talk about go-go and gentrification and the like, that is part seems very contemporary, but moving people out of their homeland is very southern, going way back. Right. And I also try to present, on the one hand, there's the mall, and on the other hand, there's Howard University.
Yep.
And think about them as different ways of recording the history of the nation.
Right.
And ultimately finding Howard to do, I think, a more powerful job of telling the story of the nation and the capital itself.
So you talk about, or we're familiar with the Great Migration.
Yes.
The two waves, the black people escaping the ravages of the South for the North, thinking it was the promised land, and then being kind of disabused of that. But you also talk about a rural migration to larger cities within the South.
Yeah.
Which I found fascinating.
Yeah.
And you call it the urban South.
Yep.
And then you question, as we were just saying, is Washington, D.C. the South? Is Maryland the South?
Right.
Is it the South by sensibility or location? Atlanta. In Atlanta, is it? It's in the South, but is it...
It's
really
different.
It's a different kind of, a different vibe. And so talk about the urban South.
Yes, and there's so many different, there's so many variations on the urban South, right? So that Atlanta is very different from New Orleans. I don't think anybody questions, people sometimes question if New Orleans is the United States, but they don't question if it's the South. In the way that people, Southerners from places like Alabama, where I'm from, or Mississippi, will say, well, Atlanta's different.
Right.
It's not quite, and it's partially because of the industry and the corporations that have settled there. It's partially because of the Northerners that settle there. I have always thought of myself as someone who doesn't come from a great migration family. So my mother and I moved up north when I was a little girl, but my family, my children are the first children the first generation born in the north. And still most of the people in their generation in my family overwhelmingly are born in Alabama, right? It was like one in California, I guess that's it, who's not born in this, and my kids, right? And so, I don't think of myself as a member of a migration family, but we did go from the rural South, northern Alabama, to Birmingham.
Yep.
Birmingham is not urban like Atlanta, but one of the things I point out is that that's a function of a set of political choices, because Birmingham and Atlanta were roughly the same size.
Mm-hmm.
Birmingham was actually blacker, but... when the airline industry, when Delta was sort of trying to figure out where to settle, the political sort of leadership in Birmingham was more interested in serving, the coal industry than the airline industry. And so it was more expensive for that to become a hub. So, it really is the story of how Atlanta becomes a much bigger place, right? And I just think it's important because, especially having spent so much time in Chicago, for example, right, when I was growing up, the migration story is really a Mississippi migration story primarily, and it's a Delta migration story, not exclusively, or Black Belt, but primarily. Although lots of people went from Mississippi to Memphis and then went to Memphis to Chicago. But that's a very particular kind of migration. That gives a particular image of the South. Like, people would talk to me about, are you going down South? You're going to be in a country? And I'm like, I'm from a city. no, I'm not going to be a country, right? There were roosters next door and chickens, but still, it was a city. And so I think that, even when we talk about the migration, when we talk about what the South means to people, it varies depending upon their point of origin. I just think that's important to attend to,
And yet, and this is one of the issues that I have with people who talk about the south side of Chicago,
yes.
is that it's painted with one brush.
Yeah.
And that is the same with the south side
That's
of
right.
the south section of this country.
So true.
Is that it is. And then and we can even think about that in terms of food. And that's
yeah.
one of the topics you understand. Right, the grits. Talk
yeah.
about grits and moonshine. You have tasted moonshine.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yes, many times. Yes, I have had shine many times.
I love the idea of Imani Pyrrha with moonshine.
I know. I don't think my mama was happy I put that in.
Right. You talk about sugar, the sweet tooth,
yes.
and all of that. But there's also something that is incredibly comforting about food. And not just in the South, but talk about its value in the South.
Yeah. So there's a... Sugar is a motif, and it's not just because I am a sort of struggling sugar addict. And this is part of why the book had to be written the way that it did. So I wanted to write a book that could make sense of why my grandmother used to say, we called her Madea. She used to say to me, put some more sugar on your cornflakes, baby.
Wow.
Put some more sugar on it.
Yeah.
And I needed to write a book that would explain the why behind that. And it was about wanting to offer me some sweetness in a difficult world. Right?
I
like
love
it was
that.
A little little sweetness, a little tension. She used to talk about not having and having to borrow sugar from Marie, who lived in the boarding house with me. She didn't have, you know, for her children. And if I just talked in a sort of, you know, like an informational way, the sugar that is like a little sweetness in hard knock living, it wouldn't come through,
yeah.
you know? Yeah.
I wanted to get to the idea of, I mean, there is this stereotype, and despite the generations of freedom fighters, having hailed from the South, there's this pervasive stereotype that Southerners are a little bit, they demur a little bit, or they're not as, which is interesting. And you make the point that most of the black revolutionaries from the 1960s who fled to Cuba, and I love the Bahamas, by the way. I love what you wrote about them. But who fled to Cuba were from the Deep South. So
yeah.
talk about that pervasive, you know, where you have... On one hand, you have these people who were, you know, definitely they were going to move heaven and earth,
yeah.
but there are people who were seen as acquiescing.
Yeah. So this came about, and there's a bunch of different moments, but one was really potent when, I guess I was watching the news, 2018 is one of the anniversaries of 2019, of the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. And the reporters on MSNBC kept saying, and you know, they respond, Black Birmingham responded peacefully. And I was like, well, that's a lie.
Yeah.
It was a riot.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's just what there was. And yeah. I said, so there's this investment in telling a particular story of the freedom struggle in the South, as though there weren't the deacons for the defense, as though there weren't, as though in Memphis people didn't bust out windows in the on Beale Street, as though. In Birmingham didn't, as though two other children didn't die the same day in Birmingham, as though there wasn't a, you know, conflagration, upheaval.
Yep.
And there's this, so that's one piece, and then there's this moment when Geronimo Jijaga Pratt says about his experience in the Black Panther Party.
Mm-hmm.
He says, listen, I was trying to look to what I had come up with in Louisiana. We had our own police force, we had our own firefighters, we had our own institutions. So many, the radical turn in Black politics needs to be understood in part as a fight for integration that white America refused.
Yeah.
It refused integration.
Yeah.
So it was a turning inward. Same thing that happened post-Reconstruction. Black people turned inward. And part of what they did, when people talk about sort of a re-engagement with Africa and a return, it was also to pick up things that were part of Southern tradition and reimagine them, right? It's part of why, you know, people start singing Lift Every Voice and Sing with their fists raised in the 70s, right? And so and in cities where people weren't really singing it as much as they had in the South. And so, yeah, so I wanted to correct that misperception. And I also want people to understand that that's what's behind the detente, right? Sometimes there's a withholding mm-hmm. that happens with Black Southerners, not because of being, less confrontational, but because if it's, something starts, it's really going to be something big, you know.
You said people mistake withholding for timidity.
Yeah, it's
which
not.
Which is amazing. Yeah, I love that. Okay, if you have a question for Imani, come to the microphone in the center.
What do you think was the hardest part of researching and writing about the South?
The hardest part? Oh, actually, all the things I had to cut out. You know, that was hard. It's such a large landscape. It's over a third of the population lives in the South, this country. There's so many different places. I had a chapter on Arkansas I had to cut out. I had a chapter on Houston I had to cut out. And so it was deciding that it couldn't be comprehensive, and so it had to have an arc and a shape, which meant lots of things would be left out. But I felt like it was what was left in could still speak to the places I couldn't get to.
And you talk about Houston a bit at the very end,
yeah.
And the oil and
yeah.
all that. And it's like, and it did not at all feel like I'm just putting it in here, but it really felt symbiotic. It felt like it
thank
was.
Thank you.
Yeah, no. It worked really well.
And thank you both so much for being here today. My question is, so the South was affected a lot by the Great Migration, and then the past, 20, 30 years, there's been an in-migration to the South. Mm-hmm. How is that, or how have you seen that affecting the South, whether it's a city like Atlanta or other places in the South?
You were talking about the reverse, I'm sorry,
the reverse migration.
Migration?
Yeah, so we have Blacks
yeah.
arriving to the South.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that, for me, one of the things that it does is remind us how much of the Great Migration the first time around was more than anything about work, mm-hmm. right? So people talk about it in terms of about racial terror and segregation and violence, and that's a piece of it, but more than anything, the boll weevil is the greatest driver, yeah. right? And so now, the cost of living is lower in the South, and in many places there's a perception that quality of life is better. So for example, on the block that my auntie lived on in Linwood, California, which was all migrants mostly from Louisiana, literally everybody has moved to Houston. Everybody. Right. And it's because it's more, Los Angeles is so expensive and it's so hard to make a way there. And so I think that migration is normal. People move because they're trying to make a way. Immigration is the same thing. They're trying. And part of the way I tell the story. So for example, in the Louisiana chapter, I talk about Louisiana businessmen who shaped the political landscape in Central America very deliberately, because I want people to understand that the migration is a constant push and pull, right? So people will act like sort of undocumented immigration. Why have these people come? And that there's a cycle that's been going on for multiple generations. And so the same thing is happening again. People are being pushed by difficult circumstances.
And Charles Blow has a book.
Yeah.
His latest book is about people, encouraging people, Black
yeah.
people to move back to the South.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Tiffany Walden. I'm the co-founder and editor-in-chief of The Tribe in Chicago. It's a media outlet. And I have kind of two questions. As a journalist, we're often taught to not insert yourself into the story. But I find stories where people do put themselves into the story to be really captivating and to add a certain tenderness to those particular stories. And I'm reading Looking for Lorraine right now, and I'm going to read your new book. And I'm wondering, how do you find that balance of, putting your experience into the works that you're doing?
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I will say I'm not a journalist, and so I don't feel, in this book, I really am a writer of creative nonfiction who uses my scholarly training as the sort of research foundation. but it's a creative endeavor, and so I don't have the same kind of, I think, expectations of objectivity. I don't really believe in objectivity, though.
Same here.
So I believe in rigor, right? So I am not objective about any of this stuff. But if I say something, I'm going to be able to back it up with a lot of information, even if it's something very personal. And sometimes what I'm doing is when there is a disjuncture between my feeling and what I learn, I expose that. I mean, so for me, for example, when I'm like, I'm Maryland, the South, and I'm like, well, wait a minute. What I felt is actually not the truth. There are Souths, plural, right? And so I think that's And even my own sort of dealing with my own sense of fragmentation in my Louisiana chapter, because I have this genealogy there that I'm not a family I'm not connected to. And so I try to use that as a way of opening up a different kind of exploration, trying to catch hold not just of my past, but the past of the place and the way it lives in the present in general. So for me, the only answer I have, and I know it's not satisfactory for everybody, is rigor. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the thing that mediates against it being too much of what I think and not what I know.
And my second question really quickly is, there's so much research that goes into your work. At what point do you kind of say, like, let me step back and start writing? Like, how do you balance the research, which is fun, and it is fun to be in the archive, like, rooms, but then it's like I have to sit down and write the thing. Like, how do you balance that?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I think it's for a book like this, it's hard to answer because so much of it is research that I've literally been doing for decades, you know, because it's related to, my research for my dissertation was late 19th, early 20th century South. I studied African American literature of the 20th. So much in legal history. So much of it was, I felt like I knew enough to know what I had to look for, right? But I also, I think, the general question for me as a writer is, all of the work is prompted by the question, right? What do I need to know to answer this question for myself, right? It also has to be, I don't write anything as a final word. Everything is an invitation to more. So I never, you know, I never think, okay. I mean, I think, for example, I wrote a biography of Lorraine Hansberry. And then Soyika Colbert, I don't know if anybody has seen her, but wrote a brilliant biography of Lorraine Hansberry. And there's a fantastic documentary. And then there's another biography coming out. And they all have their distinct place. But if you, as a writer, if you're trying to, like, claim something completely, then you don't ever have the capacity to let go. But you also don't do well, I think, by a writing community.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So my last question is, do you see yourself ever living in the South again?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so Jessamyn Ward some years ago wrote an essay about why she went home to Mississippi, and I read it, and I just cried.
Yeah.
I just, because I, you know, and when the best part of being on the tour for this book is I was in the South almost every week for the first 3 months of this year.
Wow.
And it was just... incredible. You know, my work life and my parenting life make it complicated.
Sure.
So that might, you know, it may be sometime in the future, but I feel very comfortable. I'm not shy when I'm in the South. I'm not, you know, people will talk to you.
Yeah.
I mean, I sort of feel that in Chicago too, though, which is part of how, you know, there's an ease of connection with human beings that's very different from the Northeast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love what you say about the language, me and your friend.
Me and your mama.
Right. Well, it is such a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you so much.
I adored your book. And thank you so very much for sharing your thoughts and your expertise, your brilliance with us.
Thank you so much. Thank y'all for being here.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, Stuart N. Brotman and John Palfrey discuss Brotman's new book, The First Amendment Lives On, a collection of conversations with free speech scholars and advocates. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.